Finally today, David Grimm, the online news editor for Science, is here with a few notable stories from our daily news site. Well, first, David, a new proposal to stem global warming?
Right, Stuart. This all involves a burgeoning field called geoengineering, and these are basically sometimes fairly wacky schemes for trying to cool the planet. Scientists have proposed everything from launching volcanic gas and dust, essentially into the atmosphere to block sunlight, to filling the ocean with billions of tiny bubbles to reflect sunlight, or even seeding the ocean with iron that would grow a lot of marine organisms that would consume carbon dioxide. All schemes to try to either reduce CO2 levels or greenhouse gas levels, or somehow block the sunlight so the Earth doesn't warm as fast as it is currently.
So kind of extreme measures.
Exactly. And this latest measure fits very well with all these other measures. It's essentially using tiny flying saucers to block sunlight. These tiny flying saucers, they're actually about 20 nanometers wide, so they're incredibly tiny. They operate by a phenomenon known as photoparesis. And basically what this phenomenon is if you take a material and one side of it, the top side, is made out of a different material than the other and would heat faster or slower than the other, what happens is that gas can actually build up beneath the material and actually lift it. And so what this scientist proposes is he proposed creating these 20 nanometer wide disks, essentially, and their top is made out of aluminum. Their bottoms are made out of a compound known as barium titanate. And what happens is, if you were to, say, throw this object in the air or place it on the ground, the heat differential between the top and the bottom of the object would cause the air to essentially lift these objects into the air. In fact, the scientist calculates that these objects would be lifted about 40 to 50 kilometers in the air.
So you've got a bunch of tiny sort of suspended mirrors up
there? Exactly. You've got a bunch of tiny suspended mirrors way up there in the stratosphere. And what they're doing up there is they're reflecting sunlight, and theoretically, by reflecting all that sunlight, less sun's hitting the Earth, and the Earth would start cooling, or maybe at least not warm as fast as it would otherwise.
Well, you know, I guess the trouble I have with a lot of these geoengineering schemes is kind of the law of unintended consequences. You know, I mean, could the cure be worse than the disease here?
Exactly. And that's one of the big problems with geoengineering, whether you're talking about throwing a lot of iron into the ocean, which people say could disrupt ecosystems, or what I talked about earlier in terms of putting sulfur dioxide and other components of volcanic gases into the atmosphere, that could actually destroy the ozone layer. So as you said, the cure could be worse with the disease, and the same could be true of these tiny flying saucers. The researcher who envisioned them admits that anything that affects sunlight could also affect rainfall patterns. So even though you might help cool the Earth, you might get these really wacky and sometimes disastrous weather patterns that could wreak just as much havoc as global warming does. So he's not proposing we throw all these things in the atmosphere right now. He's saying a lot more study is done. And he's actually saying, I wish we didn't have to do this at all. I wish humans were just better about controlling greenhouse gas emissions. We wouldn't even have to think about all these wacky schemes. But he's saying, if worse comes to worse, this may be a potential option.
Well, okay, getting back down to Earth, the next story, I guess, is about premature babies. Tell me about that one.
Well, Stuart, when babies are born prematurely in the hospital, doctors face a really big dilemma. Some premature babies end up just fine, even though they're born really early. Maybe they have a few minor problems in the hospital, but after a few weeks, they're doing just fine. And some premature babies don't do well at all. In fact, sometimes they can die, and if they don't die, sometimes they develop serious health issues like organ failure or respiratory failure, some big problems. The problem is that it's really hard to tell in those first few hours of life which premature babies are going to have bad outcomes and which ones are going to have good outcomes.
So when my own children were born, there was something called the Apgar test. Is that no longer done? Or
no, actually, that is still the standard. This Apgar test basically takes a few fairly common measurements, like how well a baby's moving and breathing, and even the baby's skin tone, if the baby is pale or blue, or if it's nice and healthy and pink. And it compiles all these into what's called an Apgar score, and physicians use that to try to determine how that baby's going to do. But the problem is the Apgar score is not very accurate. In fact, when it comes to predicting very serious outcomes of prematurity, it's only about 70% effective. And obviously, you want to try something that's a lot better than that. The other problem with the Apgar is there's a lot of manual work that goes into that, you know, looking at skin tone and writing down figures for that and breathing and stuff like that. And so in this new study, researchers wanted to try to develop something that was much easier, much more automatic, and ideally much more accurate than the Apgar score.
And so what did they do?
What they did was they looked at over 100 infants in a particular hospital, and these were all premature babies, and they classified these infants into two groups, the ones that they considered high risk. These are the infants that went on to develop much more serious disorders after they were born, and low risk. These were the infants that did pretty well, even though they were born prematurely. And then the researchers went back and looked at a lot of measurements that are taken automatically when a baby is born, things like how much oxygen is in the baby's blood and its respiratory rate and its heart rate. So things that this data is automatically being collected anyways in the first 3 hours of life. And the researchers fed all this data into a formula, and they said, is there anything about this data that correlates very well to how these babies do? And indeed, after they did some messing around with some mathematical algorithms, they came up with something they called the FISIS score. And this is a score which ranges from 0 to 1. And the higher premature baby rates on that score, the more likely it is to develop a serious problem after it's born. So, for example, an infant with a score of 0.8 would have about an 80% chance of developing serious complications.
So they basically worked backward from what the outcomes were and kind of modeled the best fit, if you will, of all of the factors that led to that.
Exactly.
So how well does this FISIS score actually predict things?
Well, as I said before, the APGAR's accuracy is anywhere from about 70 to 74%. And there's some more invasive tests, like taking blood from the infants, that have a range of about 82 to 90%. 1%. But the researchers found that this FISIS score, it was as good as 98% accurate in predicting outcomes for these premature babies. So not only was it much more accurate than the APGAR score, but it's a lot more accurate than these other tests that are very invasive. And the great thing about FISIS score, the researchers say, is that it's not invasive at all. We're just taking data that's automatically collected from these babies, throwing them into a formula, and it spits out a number that can really help doctors decide, you know, a lot of these hospitals have very limited resources. And so if they're confronted with a lot of premature babies, they really need to know which are the ones that we really need to put attention on and which are the ones that they don't. And so the hope is with a score like that, that's really accurate, physicians can allocate their resources accurately so that they're really treating these children that are the most at risk before they develop serious complications.
Well, that sounds quite compelling. And finally, in the news you can use department, some research on how guys can impress women on the dance floor.
That's right, Stuart. This last story is about the precise dance moves that a guy can make, or rock, as we say in the article, that will really impress a woman. The reason researchers studied this, they weren't just trying to get a bunch of guys to dance and have a lot of fun in the laboratory. There's actually evidence in the animal kingdom, besides humans, that animals use various motions, or especially the male animals use various motions to impress females. For example, male fiddler crabs have this really big claw that they sort of wave around and supposed to impress females. And male hummingbirds have this flamboyant mating dive that they do that is supposed to impress a female with their aeronautical skills. And the research said, you know, when guys dance, is it possible that they're not only just having a good time, but maybe unconsciously they're sending out some signals about how evolutionarily fit they are? In other words, how good of a mate they are because maybe they're well coordinated or strong or whatever.
Well, dancing certainly seems like something that would be hard to get a precise handle on. How did they actually study this?
Well, that's a good point, because if you just brought a bunch of guys into a room and had them dance in front of women, there's a lot of confounding factors. The main one being, if you're going to ask a woman if she's turned on by a guy's dance, the first thing that she's going to look at is how attractive the guy is. And the guy may be a great dancer, but if he's not very good looking, the woman may say, well, he's not a very good dancer, or I don't like him. So the researchers really wanted to eliminate that. And so what they did was they took a cue from James Cameron and Peter Jackson, and they recruited about 30 guys, and they put a bunch of reflective markers on various parts of their body. And they did something called motion capture technology. And this is something that's often used in the movies to create, you know, King Kong or Gollum in Lord of the Rings. And what they did was they created these computer avatars of these guys. They had these guys dance for about 30 seconds to what they call a thumping drum beat. And then they showed these avatar videos to the women, and they said, which guy do you think is the best dancer? And the researchers had done a previous study where they showed that when the woman said he's a good dancer, what she really meant is, I'm attracted to him. So this was a proxy for how attractive a guy was based on his dancing.
So don't keep us in suspense, David. I mean, what moves were the ones that worked?
We've got two videos on the site that you can check out. One is of a bad dancer, and one is
That's my group.
And one is a good dancer. And you'll see a very dramatic difference between the two. But boiled down, essentially what good dancers do is they tend to move their head and torso a lot, and they don't flail their arms and legs a lot. It turns out the secret to good dancing is really more sort of in the upper body and not having very much to do with the limbs. Whereas the guys that were bad dancers tended to sort of trudge around in a circle or make these awkward movements. These are all things that sound fairly obvious, but when you see the video, it really comes out at you. It's very striking, really, what separates a good dancer from a bad dancer.
Well, clearly this seems to matter to women, but why, actually?
Well, so researchers are wondering if it all traces back to what we see in fiddler crabs and hummingbirds. Are these signals somehow an indicator of how fit a man is? Maybe there is some sort of indicator of his strength or health. And so the research say in the next day what they want to do is figure out, okay, let's take all the dancers that the women found attractive or that they thought that were good dancers, and let's try to find out if these men are somehow healthier or stronger or in any other way more desirable from an evolutionary standpoint than the men that were bad dancers. So we'll have to wait and see a little bit for that research.
Okay, well, Dave, what other stories are you looking into on the news site?
Well, Stuart, for Science Now, we've got a story about the first hunchback dinosaur and also a story about how flying fish fly. And on Science Insider, Science's policy site, we've got a story about the International Year of Astronomy, what's going on with that. And also, we're continuing our coverage of the stem cell issue in the United States. A couple of weeks ago, a federal judge basically barred researchers from using government money in the U.S. to fund human embryonic stem cell research. And there's been a lot of new developments. We're following this on a daily basis, sometimes multiple times a day. So be sure to check out the site for updates on that and for all of these stories.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.